I is for Innocent by Sue Grafton. Chapter 1. I feel compelled to report that at the moment of death, my entire life did not pass before my eyes in a flash. There was no beckoning white light at the end of a tunnel, no warm fuzzy feeling that my long-departed loved ones were waiting on the other side. What I experienced was a little voice piping up in an outraged tone. Oh, come on, you're not serious. This is really it? Mostly, I regretted I hadn't tidied my chest of drawers the night before as I'd planned. It's painful to realize that those who mourn your untimely demise will also carry with them the indelible image of all your tatty underpants. You might question the validity of the observation, since it's obvious I didn't die when I thought I would, but let's face it, life is trivial, and my guess is that dying imparts very little wisdom to those in process. My name is Kinsey Milhone. I'm a licensed private investigator operating out of Santa Teresa, which is 95 miles north of Los Angeles. For the past 7 years, I'd been running my own small agency adjacent to the home offices of California Fidelity Insurance. My agreement with the company entitled me to the use of an attractive corner suite in exchange for the investigation of arson and wrongful death claims on an as-needed basis. In early November, that arrangement was abruptly terminated when a hotshot efficiency expert was transferred to Santa Teresa from the CF branch office in Palm Springs. I hadn't thought I'd be affected by the change in company management, since I was operating as an independent contractor instead of a bona fide California Fidelity employee. However, at our first and only meeting, this man and I took an instant dislike to each other. In the 15 minutes that constituted our entire relationship, I was rude, pugnacious, and uncooperative. The next thing I knew, I was out on the street with my client files packed up in assorted cardboard boxes. Let's not even mention the fact that my association with CF had culminated in the wholesale bust-up of a multi-million-dollar auto insurance scam. All that netted me was a surreptitious handshake from Mac Voorhees, the company vice president and avowed chicken heart, who assured me he was just as appalled by this guy as I was. While I appreciated the support, it didn't solve my problem. I needed work. I needed an office in which to do the work. Aside from the fact that my apartment was too small to serve the purpose, it felt unprofessional. Some of my clients are unsavory characters, and I didn't want those bozos to know where I lived. I had troubles enough. With the recent sharp rise in property taxes, my landlord had been forced to double my rent. He'd been more upset about the hike than I had, but according to his accountant, he'd had no choice. The rent was still very reasonable, and I had no complaints, but the increase couldn't have come at a more awkward time. I had used my savings to pay for my new car, a 1974 VW, this one pale blue, with only one minor ding in the left rear fender. My living expenses were modest, but I still didn't have a sou left at the end of the month. I've heard that no one gets fired without secretly hoping for the liberation. But that sounds like the kind of pronouncement you make before you've been given the boot. Being fired is the pits, ranking right up there with infidelity and its brutalizing effect. The ego recoils, and one's self-image is punctured like a tire by a nail. In the weeks since I'd been terminated, I'd gone through all the stages one suffers at the diagnosis of a soon-to-be-fatal disease. Anger, denial, bargaining, drunkenness, foul language, head colds, rude hand gestures, anxiety, and eating disorders of sudden onset. I'd also entertained a steady stream of loathsome thoughts about the man responsible. Lately, however, I'd begun to wonder if it wasn't true. This notion of a repressed desire to be unceremoniously shit-canned. Maybe I was bored with CF. Maybe I was burned out. Maybe I was simply longing for a change of scene. Whatever the truth, I'd begun to adjust, and I could feel the optimism rising through my veins like maple syrup. It was more than a matter of survival. One way or another, I knew I'd prevail. For the time being, I was renting a spare room in the law offices of Kingman and Ives. Lonnie Kingman is in his early 40s, 5'4", 205 pounds, a weightlifting fanatic, perpetually pumped up on steroids, testosterone, vitamin B12, and caffeine. He's got a shaggy head of dark hair, like a pony in the process of shedding a winter coat. His nose looks like it's been busted about as often as mine has. I know from the various degrees framed and hung on his wall that he received a B.A. from Harvard and an M.B.A. from Columbia, and then graduated summa cum laude from Stanford Law School. His partner, John Ives, while equally credentialed, prefers the quiet, non-glamorous aspects of the practice. His forte is appellate civil work, where he enjoys a reputation as an attorney of uncommon imagination, solid research, and exceptional writing skills. Since Lonnie and John established the firm some 6 years ago, the support staff has expanded to include a receptionist, two secretaries, and a paralegal who doubles as a runner. Martin Cheltenham, the third attorney in the firm, while not a formal partner, is Lonnie's best friend, leasing office space from him in the same way I do. In Santa Teresa, all the flashy cases seem to go to Lonnie Kingman. He's best known for his criminal defense work, but his passion is complex trials in any case involving accidental injury or wrongful death, which is how our paths crossed in the first place. I'd done some work for Lonnie in the past, and aside from the fact that I'm occasionally in need of his services myself, I figured he'd be good for the referrals. From his point of view, it didn't hurt to have an investigator on the premises. As with California Fidelity, I was not an employee. I worked as an independent contractor, providing professional services and billing accordingly. To celebrate the new arrangement, I went out and bought myself a handsome tweed blazer to wear with my usual jeans and turtleneck. I thought I looked pretty snappy in the outfit. It was a Monday early in December when I first got involved in the Isabel Barney murder case. I'd driven down to Cottonwood twice that day, 2 10-mile round trips, trying to serve a subpoena on a witness in a battery case. The first time, he wasn't home. The second time, I caught him just as he pulled into his driveway from work. I handed him the papers, disregarding his annoyance, and took off again with my car radio thundering to mask his parting remarks, which were rude. He used a couple of words I hadn't heard in years. On my way into town, I did a detour past the office. The Kingman Building is a 3-story stucco structure with parking tucked in at ground level and 2 floors of offices above. Across the facade, there are 6 pairs of floor-to-ceiling French doors that open inward for ventilation, each flanked by tall wooden shutters painted the soft verdigris of a greening copper roof. A shallow, wrought-iron bracket is secured across the lower half of each set of doors. The effect is largely decorative, but in a pinch might prevent a suicidal dog or a client's sulky child from flinging itself out the window in a fit of pique. The building straddles the property and has a driveway that passes through an arch on the right, opening up into a tiny parking lot in the rear. The one drawback is the parsimonious assignment of parking spaces. There are 6 permanent tenants and 12 parking spots. Since Lonnie owns the building, his law firm had been allotted 4. One for John, one for Martin, one for Lonnie, and one for Lonnie's secretary, Ida Ruth. The remaining 8 places were parceled out according to the individual leases. The rest of us had a choice of street parking or one of the public lots 3 blocks away. The local rates are absurdly cheap, given big city standards, but on my limited budget, the tab mounts up. Street parking downtown isn't metered, but it's restricted to 90 minutes, and the meter maids are quick to ticket you if you cheat by so much as a minute. As a consequence, I spent a lot of time either moving my car or cruising the area trying to ferret out a spot that was both close by and free. Happily, this exasperating situation only extends until 6 o'clock p.m. It was then 6:15, and the third-floor windows along the front were dark, suggesting that everyone had already gone home for the day. When I drove through the arch, I saw Lonnie's car was still in its slot. Ida Ruth's Toyota was gone, so I eased my car into her space next to his Mercedes. An unfamiliar pale blue Jaguar sedan was parked in John's slot. I hung my head out the car window and craned my neck. Lonnie's office lights were on, two oblongs of pale yellow against the slanting shadows from the roof. He was probably with a client. The days were getting steadily shorter, and a gloom settled over the town at that hour. Something in the air generated a longing for a wood fire, companionship, and the kind of cocktail that looks elegant in the print ads and tastes like liniment. I told myself I had work to do, but in truth it was just a way to postpone going home. I locked my car and headed for the stairwell, which was tucked into a hollow core that extended up the center of the building like a chimney flue. The stairs were inky, and I had to use my little keychain flashlight to break up the darkness. The third-floor corridor was in shadow, but I could see lights in the reception area through the frosted glass in the front door. By day, the whole third-floor complex was cheerful and well-lighted, with white walls, burnt orange carpeting, a forest of greenhouse plants, Scandinavian furniture, and original artwork in bright crayon tones. The office I was renting had served as a combination conference room and kitchen, and was outfitted now with my desk and swivel chair, file cabinets, a small flop-out couch that could double as a bed in an emergency, a telephone, and my answering machine. I was still listed in the yellow pages under investigators, and people calling the old number were advised of the new. In the week since the move, while some business had trickled in, I'd been forced to resort to process serving to make ends meet. At $20 a pop, I was never going to get rich, but on a good day I could sometimes pick up an extra $100. Not bad if I could sandwich it in with other investigative work. I let myself in quietly, not wanting to disturb Lonnie if he was in the middle of a conference. His office door was open, and I glanced in automatically as I went past. He was chatting with a client, but when he caught sight of me, he raised his hand and beckoned. "Kinsey, could you spare a minute? There's someone here I want you to meet." I backtracked to his doorway. Lonnie's client was seated in the black leather wing chair, with his back to me. As Lonnie stood up, his client stood too, turning to look at me as we were introduced. His aura was dark, if you buy that kind of talk. "Kenneth Voigt," Lonnie said. "This is Kinsey Milhone, the private investigator I was telling you about." We shook hands, going through the usual litany of greetings while we checked each other out. He was in his early 50s, with dark hair and dark brown eyes, his brows separated by deep indentations that had been set there by a scowl. His face was blunt, his wide forehead softened by a tongue of thinning hair that was brushed to one side. He smiled politely at me, but his face didn't brighten much. A pale sheen of perspiration seemed to glimmer on his forehead. While he was on his feet, he shed his sport coat and tossed it on the couch. The shirt he wore under it was dark gray, a short-sleeved polo with a three-button placket open at the neck. Dark hair curled from his shirt collar, and a mat of dark hair covered his arms. He was narrow through the shoulders, and the muscles in his arms were stringy and undeveloped. He should have worked out at a gym, for his stress levels, if nothing else. He took out a handkerchief, dabbing at his forehead and his upper lip. "I want her to hear this," Lonnie was saying to Voigt. "She can go through the files tonight and start first thing in the morning."
"Fine with me," Voigt said.
The two sat down again. I folded myself into one corner of the couch and pulled my legs up under me, considerably cheered by the prospect of a paycheck. One advantage in the work for Lonnie is he screens out all the deadbeats. Lonnie offered me a word of explanation before the conversation continued.
"The PI we were using just dropped dead of a heart attack. Morley Shine, you know him?"
"Of course," I said, startled. "Morley died? When was this?"
"Last night about 8. I was gone over the weekend and didn't get back till after midnight, so I didn't hear about it myself until this morning when Dorothy called me."
Morley Shine had been around ever since I could remember. Not a close friend, but certainly a man I could count on if I found myself in a pinch. He and the fellow who trained me as a PI had been partners for years. At some point, they'd had a falling out, and each had gone into business for himself. Morley was in his late 60s, tall and slump-shouldered, probably 80 pounds overweight, with a round, dimpled face, wheezing laugh, and fingers yellowed from all the cigarettes he smoked. He had access to snitches and informants in every correctional facility in the state, plus contacts in all the relevant local information pools. I'd have to quiz Lonnie later about the circumstances of Morley's death. For the time being, I concentrated on Kenneth Voigt, who had backed up his narrative so he could get a running start. He stared down at the floor, hands clasped loosely in his lap.
"My ex-wife was murdered 6 years ago. Isabel Barney. You remember the case?"
The name meant nothing. "I don't think so," I said.
"Someone unscrewed the fisheye in the middle of the front door. He knocked, and when she flipped on the porch light and peered out, he fired a .38 through the spy hole. She died instantly."
My memory kicked in with a jolt. "That was her? I do remember that much. I can't believe it's been 6 years." I nearly added my only other recollection, that the guy alleged to have killed her was her estranged husband. Apparently not Kenneth Voigt. But who? I made eye contact with Lonnie, who interjected a comment, picking up on my question as if with ESP.
"The guy's name is David Barney. He was acquitted, in case you're curious."
Voigt changed positions in his chair as if the very name made him itch.
"The bastard."
Lonnie said, "Go on with your story, Ken. I didn't mean to interrupt. You might as well give her the background as long as she's here." It seemed to take a few seconds for him to remember what he'd been saying.
"We were married for 4 years, a second marriage for both. We have a 10-year-old daughter named Shelby, who's off at boarding school. She was 4 when Iz was killed. Anyway, Isabel and I had been having problems. Nothing unusual as far as I knew. She got involved with Barney. She married him a month after our divorce became final. All he wanted was her money. Everybody knew that except poor dumb Iz. And I don't mean any insult to her when I say that. I loved the woman truly, but she was gullible as they come. She was bright, and she was talented, but she had no sense of self-worth, which made her a sitting duck for anybody with a kind word. You probably know women like that. Emotionally dependent, no self-esteem to speak of. She was an artist, and while I had tremendous admiration for her ability, it was hard to watch her throw her life away." I found myself tuning out his analysis of her character. His generalizations about women were obnoxious, and he'd evidently told the same story so often, his rendering of events was flat and passionless. The drama was not about her anymore. It was the tale of his reaction. My eye wandered over to the pile of fat manila folders on Lonnie's desk. I could see Voigt/Barney written across the spine. 2 cardboard boxes, stacked against the wall, contained additional files, judging by the labels affixed to one side. Everything Voigt was saying was going to be right there, a compilation of facts without all the editorials attached. It seemed weird to me. What he said might be true, but it wasn't necessarily believable. Some folks are like that. The simplest recollection just sounds false in the rendering. He went on for a bit, speaking in closely knit paragraphs that didn't yield the opportunity for interruption. I wondered how often Lonnie had served as his audience. I noticed he'd disconnected, too. While Kenneth Voigt's mouth was moving, Lonnie picked up a pencil and began to turn it end over end, tapping on his legal pad first with the point and then with the eraser. I turned my attention to Ken Voigt. "How'd the guy get off?" I asked as soon as he paused for breath. Lonnie jumped in, apparently impatient to get down to the meat of the matter.
"Dink Jordan prosecuted. What a yawn that was. Jesus! I mean, the man is competent, but he's got no style. He thought he could win on the merits of the case."
Lonnie snorted at the absurdity of the assumption. So now we're suing the shit out of David Barney for wrongful death. I hate the guy. Just hate him. The minute he pled not guilty, I told Ken we should jump on the son of a bitch with hobnail boots. I couldn't talk him into it. We filed and got him served, but then Ken insisted we sit on it.
Voight frowned uncomfortably.
You were right, Lon. I see it now. But you know how it is. My wife, Francesca, was opposed to our reopening the investigation. It's painful for everyone. Me more than most. I simply couldn't handle it.
Lonnie crossed his eyes. He didn't have a lot of sympathy for what people could or couldn't handle. His job was to handle it. Voight's job was to turn him loose.
Hey, okay, skip that. It's water under the bridge. It took a year to get him tried and acquitted on the criminal charges. In the meantime, Ken here watches David Barney work his way through Isabel's money. And believe me, there's plenty of it. Most of which would have gone to his daughter Shelby if Barney'd been convicted. Finally, the family reaches a point where they can't stand it anymore, so Ken comes back to me and we get into gear. Meanwhile, Barney's attorney, a guy named Foss, files a discretionary motion to dismiss for lack of prosecution. I whip into court and tap dance my tiny heart out. The motion was denied, but the judge made it clear he wasn't happy with me. Now, of course, David Barney and this jerk who represents him are using every delay they can think of, and then some. They dicker around and dicker around. We're going through all the discovery, right? The guy's been acquitted in criminal court, so what difference does it make what he says at this point? But he's tight-lipped. He's tense. That's because he's guilty as hell. Oh, and here, check this. Ken here has a guy shows up. Turns out he shared a cell with David Barney. This guy's been following the case. He sits in on the trial just to see what's going on, and he's telling us Barney as good as admitted he killed her as he's walking out the courtroom door. The informant's been hard to nail down, which is why I want to get the sucker served first thing.
What good's it going to do? I asked. David Barney can't be tried again on the murder one.
Exactly. Which is why we kicked it over to the civil side. We've got a much better shot at him there, which he damn well knows. The guy's really dragging his feet, doing everything he can to hinder and obstruct. We file a motion. He's got 30 days to answer, so his attorney, what a geek, waits until day 29 and then files a demurrer. Anything to string it out. He's throwing up roadblocks left and right. We bring Barney in for a deposition, and he pleads the fifth. So we take him into court and force him to testify. The judge orders the guy to answer because he has no Fifth Amendment rights. There's no danger of prosecution because jeopardy has attached. Back we go on the depot. So now he takes the fifth again. We take him in on the contempt, but in the meantime we're running up against the court statute.
Lonnie, I said.
We're humming and humming, and it's not working for us. We're coming up to the 5-year statute, and we really need to make the case happen. We're on the master calendar, and we've been given priority, and now Morley drops dead.
Lonnie, I sang. I raised my hand to get his attention. He stopped.
Just tell me what you need, and I'll go out and get it for you.
Lonnie laughed and tossed his pencil at me.
This is why I like her. No bullshit, he said to Voight.
He reached over and pushed the stack of files in my direction.
This is everything we got, though it's a bit disorganized. There's an inventory on top. Just make sure it's all in there somewhere before you start work. Once you're familiar with the basics, we can figure out where the gaps are. In the meantime, I want you two to get acquainted. You're going to be seeing a lot of each other in the next month.
Voight and I smiled politely at Lonnie without looking at one another. He didn't seem to feel any more excited about the prospects than I did. Chapter 2 I ended up staying at the office until midnight.
The accumulated files on Isabel Barney spilled over the tops of the two cardboard cartons, each of which weighed over 40 pounds. I nearly developed a hernia hauling the boxes from Lonnie's office to mine. There was no way I could get through all that data at one sitting, so I figured I might as well take my time. Lonnie wasn't kidding when he said the files were disorganized. According to the inventory, the first box should have contained copies of police reports, transcripts from the murder trial, the complaint Lonnie'd filed in the civil action in the Santa Teresa County Superior Court, all the demurrers, answers, and cross-complaints. I couldn't even be sure that the trial transcripts were complete. What files I could spot were lumped together in one of those annoying hodgepodges that make finding anything a chore. The second box supposedly contained copies of all of Morley Shine's reports, affidavits, transcripts from the numerous depositions taken, and pages of supporting documentation. Fat chance. I could see the list of witnesses that Morley had talked to. He'd been billing Lonnie on a regular monthly basis since June 1. But not all of the corresponding written reports were in evidence. It looked like he'd served about half the subpoenas for the upcoming trial, but most of those seemed to be repeat witnesses from the criminal proceedings. 8 signed civil subpoenas, with instructions for service attached, were clipped together in a folder. I didn't see that he'd served any new witnesses, unless the yellow server's copies were filed somewhere else. From a scribbled note, I gathered that the informant's name was Curtis McIntyre, whose telephone number was a disconnect, and whose last known address was no good. I made a note to myself to track him down first, as per Lonnie's request. I leafed through page after page of interrogatories and responses, making an occasional note to myself. As with a jigsaw puzzle, what I hoped to do was to familiarize myself with the picture on the box lid, and then proceed to put the pieces together one section at a time. I knew I'd be repeating some of Morley Shine's investigation, but his approach tended to be a bit ham-fisted, and I thought I'd do better if I started from scratch, at least in the sensitive areas. I wasn't sure what to do about the gaps in the files. I hadn't finished going through the boxes yet, and I could tell I was going to have to empty everything out and repack the data so they would match the index. Certain avenues Morley'd pursued appeared to be dead ends and could probably be eliminated unless something new cropped up. He'd probably been keeping all the current files in his office or at home, which I did myself if I was still in the process of transcribing notes. The bare bones of the story were much as Kenneth Voight had indicated. Isabel Barney died sometime between 1 o'clock and 2 o'clock a.m. on December 26th, when a .38 caliber weapon was fired at point-blank range through the peephole in her front door. The ballistics expert called it a near-contact shooting, with the hole in the door acting almost like an extension of the barrel and Isabel's eye almost touching the door. The wood around the hole was blown out at right angles to the hole and toward Isabel, with some fragments probably blown back toward the killer as well. In a dry parenthetical note, the ballistics expert suggested that the blast might well have forced material back into the barrel itself, perhaps jamming the gun, and thus making a second shot problematic, if not impossible. I skipped the rest of that paragraph. The muzzle flash had singed the wood inside the hole, charring it slightly. The report noted powder residue on the outside of the door, around the hole, inside the hole, and also around the hole on the inside of the door. Much of the area was splintered by the gas pressure. The bird shot and the remnants of blue plastic cap removed from the wound indicated that the bullet was a Glazer safety slug, a light, high-velocity round consisting of bird shot suspended in a viscous medium encased in a copper jacket with a plastic nose cap. When the slug hits a medium like flesh with a high water content, the plastic cap separates, The copper jacket peels back, and the birdshot spreads out rapidly, transferring all of the energy in the slug to the flesh. Because each piece is small and of low mass, it dumps its energy quickly and stays in the body. Hence the name safety slug. Bystanders are not endangered by an over-penetrating bullet. And since the safety slug also disintegrates against hard surfaces, such as skulls, ricochets are minimized as well. No getting around it, I thought. This killer was just too considerate. According to the pathologist, the bullet, along with fragments of metal and wood, entered the victim's right eye. The autopsy report spelled out in highly technical detail the destruction to soft tissue left in its wake. Even with my sketchy knowledge of anatomy, it was clear death was instantaneous and therefore painless. The machinery of life had shut down long before the nervous system had a chance to register the agony such a wound would inflict. It's hard to have faith in your fellow man when you're forced to look at some of his handiwork. I disconnected my emotional machinery while I studied the autopsy x-rays and photographs. I work best when I'm armed with an unflinching view of reality, but the detachment is not without its dangers. Unplug yourself often and you risk losing touch with your feelings altogether. There were 10 color photographs, each with a nightmarish quality of violated flesh. This is what death is, I reminded myself. This is what homicide really looks like in the raw. I've met killers, soft-spoken, pleasant, and courteous, whose psychological denial is so profound that their perpetration of a killing seems inconceivable. The dead are mute, but the living still have voice with which to protest their innocence. Often their objections are noisy and pious, impossible to refute since the one person who could condemn them has been silenced forever. The final testimony from Isabel Barney was framed in the language of her fatal injury, a devastating portrait of waste and loss. I tucked the pictures back in the envelope and moved on to a copy of the case notes Dink Jordan had sent over to Lonnie. Dink's real name was Dinsmore. He referred to himself as Dennis, but nobody else did. He was in his 50s, bland and gray, a man without energy, humor, or eloquence. As a public prosecutor, he was competent, but he had no sense of theater. His delivery was so slow and so methodical, it was like reading the entire Bible through a microscope. I'd once watched him lay out his closing arguments in a spectacular felony murder trial, with two jurors nodding off and two more so bored they were nearly comatose. David Barney's attorney was a man named Herb Foss, whom I didn't know at all. Lonnie claimed he was a jerk, but you had to give him credit for getting David Barney off. While there had been no witnesses to the shooting, and the murder weapon was never found, evidence showed that Barney had purchased a .38 caliber revolver some 8 months before the murder. He claimed the gun had been removed from his bed table at some point during the Labor Day weekend, when the couple had given a large dinner party in honor of some friends from Los Angeles, Don and Julie Seeger. When he was questioned about his reasons for not filing a police report, he maintained that he'd discussed it with Isabel, who'd been reluctant to confront her guests with the alleged theft. During the trial, Isabel's sister testified that the couple had been talking for months about a separation. David Barney contended that the breach between them wasn't serious. However, the gun theft incident precipitated a quarrel, which culminated in Isabel's ordering him to move out. There seemed to be much disagreement about the prognosis for the marriage. David Barney claimed the relationship was stable but stormy, that he and Isabel had been in the process of negotiating their differences. Observers seemed to feel that the marriage was dead. But that might have been wishful thinking on their part. Whatever the truth, the situation deteriorated rapidly. David Barney moved out on September 15th and then proceeded to do everything in his power to regain Isabel's affections. He made frequent phone calls. He sent flowers. He sent gifts. When his attentions became annoying, instead of giving her the breathing space she requested, he redoubled his efforts. He left a single red rose on the hood of her car every morning. He left jewelry on her doorstep, sent her sentimental cards in the mail. The more she rejected him, the more obsessed he became. During October and November, he called her day and night, hanging up if she answered. When she had her number changed, he managed to acquire the new unlisted number and continued phoning her at all hours. She got an answering machine. He continued to call, leaving the line open until the message tape ran out. She told friends she felt she was under siege. In the meantime, he leased a house in the same stylish section of Horton Ravine. If she left the house, he followed her. If she stayed home, he parked across the road and watched the house through binoculars, keeping track of visitors, repairmen, and the household help. Isabel called the police. She filed complaints. Finally, her attorney had a restraining order issued, prohibiting phone calls, written communication, and his approach anywhere within 200 yards of her person, her property, or her automobile. His determination seemed to subside, but by then the harassment had taken its toll. Isabel was terrified. By the time Christmas came, she was a nervous wreck, eating little, sleeping poorly, subject to anxiety, panic, and tremors. She was pale. She was haggard. She was drinking too much. She was agitated by company and frightened to be alone. She sent the 4-year-old Shelby to live with her father. Ken Voigt had remarried, though some witnesses suggested that he'd never quite recovered from his divorce from her. Isabel took tranquilizers to get through the day. At night, she popped down sleeping pills. Finally, the Seegers prevailed on her to pack her bags and accompany them on a trip to San Francisco. They were en route to Santa Teresa to pick her up when the electronic fuel injection on the car went out. They called and left a message to let her know they'd be late. From midnight until approximately 12:45, Isabel, feeling anxious and excited about the trip, had a lengthy telephone conversation with a former college roommate who lived in Seattle. Sometime after that, she heard a rap at the door and went downstairs, assuming the Seegers had arrived. She was fully dressed, smoking a cigarette, her suitcases already lined up in the foyer. She flipped on the porch light and put her eye to the spy hole before opening the door. Instead of seeing visitors, she was staring down the bore of the .38 that killed her. The Seegers showed up at 2:20 and realized something was wrong. They alerted Isabel's sister, who was living in a cottage on the property. She used her key to let them in through the rear. The alarm system was still armed at the perimeter. As soon as they spotted her, the Seegers called the police. By the time the medical examiner arrived at the scene, Isabel's body temperature had dropped to 98.1. Using the Moritz formula and adjusting for the temperature in the foyer, her body weight, clothing, and the temperature and conductivity of the marble floor on which she lay, the medical examiner placed the time of death roughly between 1 o'clock a.m. and 2 o'clock a.m. At noon the next day, David Barney was arrested and charged with first-degree murder, to which he entered a plea of not guilty. Even that early in the game, it was clear that the evidence against him was largely circumstantial. However, in the state of California, the two elements of a homicide, the death of the victim and the existence of criminal agency, may be proved circumstantially or inferentially. A finding of murder in the first degree can be sustained where no body is produced, where no direct evidence of death is produced, and where there is no confession. David Barney had signed a prenuptial agreement that limited his financial settlement if they divorced. At the same time, he was listed as the prime beneficiary on her life insurance policies. And as her widower, he stood to inherit the community property portion of her business, which was estimated at $2.6 million. David Barney had no real alibi for the time of her death. Dink Jordan felt he had more than enough evidence to convict. As it happened, the trial lasted 3 weeks, and after 6 hours of closing arguments and 2 days of deliberations, the jury voted for acquittal. David Barney walked out of the courtroom not only a free man, but very rich. Interviewed later, some jurors admitted to a strong suspicion that he'd killed her, but they hadn't been persuaded beyond a reasonable doubt. What Lonnie Kingman was attempting by filing the wrongful death suit was to retry the case in civil court, where the burden of proof is based on a preponderance of evidence, instead of the reasonable doubt formula of a criminal prosecution. As I understood matters, it would still be necessary for the plaintiff, Kenneth Voigt, to establish that David Barney killed Isabel, and further, that the killing was felonious and intentional. But the onus would be eased by the shift to proof by preponderance. What was at stake here was not Barney's freedom, but any profits he'd garnered from the crime itself. If he'd killed her for money, at least he'd be stripped of his gains. I realized I was yawning for the third time in a row. My hands were filthy, and I'd reached the point in my reading where my mind was wandering. Morley Shine's methodology had really been slipshod, and I found myself irritated with the poor man in death. There's nothing quite as irksome as someone else's mess. I left the files where they were and locked my office door. I let myself out into the third-floor corridor and locked the door behind me. Mine was the only car left in the parking lot. I pulled out of the driveway and turned right, heading toward town. When I reached State Street, I hung a left and headed home, cruising through the empty, well-lighted downtown area of Santa Teresa. Most of the buildings are only 2 stories high, the Spanish-style architecture of the ground-hugging variety, due to frequent earthquakes. In the summer of 1968, for instance, there was a swarm of 66 tremors, ranging in severity from 1.5 to 5.2 on the Richter scale, the latter being strong enough to slop half the water out of a swimming pool. I felt a surge of regret when I passed my old building at 903 State. By now, someone new had probably moved into the space. I ought to talk to Vera, the CF claims manager, to find out what had happened in the weeks since I'd been gone. I hadn't seen her since she and Neil got married on Halloween night. As a side effect of being fired, I was losing touch with a lot of people I knew. Darcy Pascoe, Mary Bellflower. The notion of Christmas in the new office setting seemed strange somehow. I narrowly missed the light at the intersection of Anaconda and 101. I came to a stop and turned my engine off, waiting the 4 minutes for the light to turn green again. The highway was deserted, empty lanes of asphalt stretching out in both directions. The light finally changed, and I zoomed across, turning right at Cabana, the boulevard paralleling the beach. I took another right onto Bay, and a left onto my street, which was narrow and tree-lined, mostly single-family dwellings with an occasional condo. I found a parking spot 2 doors away from my apartment. I locked my car and scanned the darkened neighborhood by habit. I like to be out by myself at this hour, though I try to be vigilant and exercise appropriate caution. I let myself into the side yard, lifting the gate on its hinge to avoid the squeak. My apartment was once a single-car garage attached to the main house by a breezeway, which had been converted to a sunroom. Both my apartment and the sunroom had been reconstructed after a bomb blast, and I now had an additional loft sleeping space with a second bath built in. My outside light was on. Compliments of my landlord, Henry Pitts, who never goes to bed without peering out his window to see if I'm safely home. I locked the door behind me and went through my usual nighttime routine, securing all the doors and windows. I turned on my little black-and-white TV for company while I tidied my apartment. Since I'm usually gone during the day, I find myself doing personal chores at night. I've been known to vacuum at midnight and grocery shop at 2 a.m., Since I live alone, it isn't hard to keep the place picked up, but every 3 or 4 months I do a systematic cleaning, tackling one small section at a time on a rotating basis.
That night, even taking time to scrub the kitchen, I was in bed by 1 o'clock.
Tuesday, I woke at 6 o'clock. I pulled on my sweats and tied the laces of my Nikes in a double spit knot. I brushed my teeth, splashed some water on my face, and ran wet fingers through my sleep-flattened hair. My run was perfunctory, more form than content, but at the end of it, I was at least in touch with some energy. I used the time to tune into the day, a moving meditation meant to focus my mind as well as coordinate my limbs. I was dimly aware that I hadn't been taking very good care of myself of late, a combination of stress, irregular sleep, and too much junk food. Time to clean up my act. I showered and dressed, ate a bowl of cereal with skim milk, and headed back to the office. As I passed Ida Ruth's desk, I paused for a quick chat about her weekend, leisure she usually fills with backpacking, horse trails, and hair-raising rock climbs. She's 35 and unmarried, a robust vegetarian with windswept blonde hair and brows bleached by the sun. Her cheekbones are wide, her ruddy complexion unsoftened by makeup. While she's always dressed well, she looks like she'd prefer wearing flannel shirts, chinos, and hiking boots. If you want to talk to Lonnie, you better scoot on in. He's got a court appearance coming up in 10 minutes. Thanks, I'll do that. I found him at his desk. He'd shed his coat and had his shirt sleeves rolled up. His tie was askew, and his shaggy hair stood out around his head like wheat in need of threshing. Through the windows behind him, I could see clear blue skies with a scrim of mauve and gray mountains in the background. It was a gorgeous day. A thick tumble of vivid magenta bougainvillea camouflaged a white brick wall 2 buildings away.
"How's it going?" he asked.
"All right, I guess. I haven't finished going through the boxes yet, but it seems pretty disorganized."
"Yeah, well, filing was never Morley's strong suit."
"Girls just naturally do that so much better," I said dryly. Lonnie smiled as he jotted a note to himself, presumably concerning the case he was working on.
"We ought to talk fees. What's your hourly rate?"
"What was Morley charging?"
"The usual 50," he said idly.
He had opened a drawer and was sorting through his files, so he couldn't see my face. Morley was getting 50? I couldn't believe it. Either men are outrageous or women are fools.
Guess which, I thought.
My standard fee has always been $30 an hour plus mileage. I only missed half a beat. "Bump it up $5 and I won't charge you mileage."
"Sure," he said.
"What about instructions?"
"That's up to you. Carte blanche."
"Are you serious?"
"Of course. You can do anything you want. As long as you keep your nose clean," he added in haste. "Barney's attorney would love nothing better than to catch us with our pants down, so no dirty tricks."
"That's no fun. But it allows you to testify without being thrown out of court, and that's critical." He glanced at his watch.
"I gotta run."
He grabbed his suit coat from a hanger and shrugged back into it. He straightened his tie and snapped his briefcase shut and was halfway out the door.
"Lonnie, wait a minute. Where do you want me to start?"
He smiled.
"Find me a witness who can put the guy at the murder scene."
"Oh, right," I said to the empty room. I sat down and read another 5 pounds of garbled information. Maybe I could sweet-talk Ida Ruth into helping me reconstruct the files. The first box seemed immaculate by comparison to the second. My first chore was going to be to stop by Morley Shine's house to see what files he had there. Before I left the office, I made a few preliminary calls. I had a pretty good sense of who I wanted to talk to, and it was then a matter of setting up some appointments. I got through to Isabel's sister, Simone, who agreed to talk to me around noon at her place. I also had a quick chat with a woman named Yolanda Weidman, who was married to Isabel's former boss. He was tied up in his home office and would be until 3, so she suggested I stop by later in the afternoon. The third call I placed was to Isabel's longtime best friend. Ree Parsons wasn't in, but I left a message on her machine. giving her my name and telephone number, indicating that I'd try again.
Chapter 3.
Since the police station was only a block away, I decided to start with Lieutenant Dolan in homicide. He was out with the flu, but Sergeant Cordero was there. I spotted Lieutenant Becker in the corner, deep in conversation with someone I took to be a suspect, a white guy in his 20s, looking sullen and uncooperative. I knew Becker better than Cordero, but if I waited until he was free, he'd end up quizzing me about my relationship with Jonah Robb and missing persons. I hadn't seen Jonah in 6 or 8 months, and I didn't want to generate any contact at this point. Sherry Cordero was an oddity in the department. Being a female and Hispanic, she managed to fill 2 minority slots simultaneously. She was 29, short, buxom, smart, tough, somewhat abrasive in ways that I could never quite define. She never said anything offensive, but the guys in the department were not entirely at ease with her. I understood what she was up against. The Santa Teresa Police Department is better than most, but it's never easy being a woman and a cop. If Sherry erred on the side of being humorless, it was no surprise. She was in the middle of a phone conversation, which she converted to Spanish the minute I arrived. I sat down in the leatherette and metal chair beside her desk. She held up a finger, indicating she'd be with me momentarily. She had a little artificial Christmas tree on her desk. It was decorated with candy canes, and I helped myself to one. The nice thing about being in the presence of someone on the telephone is that you can study the person at your leisure without being thought rude. I unwrapped the candy cane and tossed the cellophane in the trash. She was clearly engaged in the subject at hand, gesturing vigorously to make her point. She had a good face, rather plain, and she wore little makeup. One of her 2 front teeth had a corner clipped off, and it added a whimsical note to an otherwise stern expression. While I watched, she began to doodle on a legal pad. A cowboy stabbed in the chest with a cartoon knife. She finished her conversation and turned her attention to me without any visible transition.
Yes?
I was looking for Lieutenant Dolan, but Emerald tells me he's out sick. He's got that bug that's been going around. Have you had that thing? I was out for a week. It's the pits. So far I've been spared, I said. How long's he been out?
Just 2 days. He'll come dragging back in, looking like death. Is there something I can help you with?
Probably. I've been hired by Lonnie Kingman in a wrongful death suit. The defendant is David Barney. I was curious about the scuttlebutt. Were you here back then?
I was still a dispatcher, but I've heard him talk.
Man, they were pissed when he walked. He looked good for the shooting, but the jury wasn't buying. Talk about frustrated. Lieutenant Dolan was mad enough to bite through nails. From what I hear, David Barney's former cellmate claims he as good as confessed once the verdict came down.
You're talking about Curtis McIntyre. Guy's in the county jail, and if you want him, you better make it quick. He gets out this week after doing 90 days on a battery, she said. Did you hear about Morley Shine?
Lonnie mentioned that last night. But I didn't hear the details. How'd it happen?
What I heard, he just keeled over dead. He'd been in bed with the same damn flu, but I guess he was feeling better. He was having dinner Sunday night.
You know Morley. He hated to miss a meal. Got up from the table and dropped in his tracks.
He had heart trouble?
For years, but he never took it serious. I mean, he was under doctor's care, but it never seemed to faze him. He was always joking about his ticker.
That's too bad, I said. I'm really sorry to see him go.
Me too. I can't believe how terrible I feel.
Roll call, somebody told me Morley Shine died? I busted out crying. I swear to God, I surprised myself. It's not like we were close. We used to talk over at the courthouse if I was waiting to testify on a case.
He was always hanging around there, chain-smoking camels, munching Fritos, or something from the vending machine.
It bums me out. All those old guys are dropping dead.
How come they didn't take better care of themselves?
Her phone rang, and she was quickly caught up in another matter.
I gave her a quick wave and moved away from her desk. In essence, she'd told me what I'd wanted to know. The cops were convinced David Barney was guilty. That didn't make it true, but it was another precinct heard from. I stopped off in Records and asked Emerald if I could borrow the phone. I called Ida Ruth and had a quick chat with her, asking her to set up an interview for me with Curtis McIntyre at the jail later in the morning. Visiting hours are ordinarily limited to Saturday afternoons, 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock. But since I was working as Lonnie Kingman's representative, I could talk to him at my convenience. Oh, the joys of the legitimate endeavor! I'd spent so many years skulking through the bushes, I could hardly get used to it. With that taken care of, I asked her for Morley Shine's home address. Morley had lived in Colgate, the township bordering Santa Teresa on the north. Colgate consists largely of light industry and tract housing with assorted businesses lined up along the main street. Where the area was once farmland and citrus groves, the uninhabited countryside has now given way to service stations, bowling alleys, funeral homes, drive-in theaters, motels, fast food restaurants, carpet outlets, and supermarkets, with no visible attention paid to aesthetics or architectural unity. Morley and his wife, Dorothy, owned a modest three-bedroom home off South Peterson in one of the older housing developments between the highway and the mountains. My guess was the house had gone up in the 50s, before the builders really got clever about differentiating exteriors. Here, the Swiss chalet-style trim was painted either dirt brown or blue. The two-car garages designed so they stuck out in front, overpowering the entrances. Wooden shutters matched the wooden flower boxes planted with drooping pansies, which on closer inspection turned out to be entirely fake. The whole neighborhood seemed dispirited, from the patchy lawns to the cracked concrete driveways where every second house had a car up on blocks. Somehow the Christmas decorations only made things worse. Most of the houses were trimmed now in multicolored lights. One of Morley's neighbors seemed to be in competition with the house across the street. Both had covered every available stretch of yard with seasonal items ranging from plastic Santas to plastic wise men. This was now Tuesday morning. Morley had died on Sunday night, and while I was uneasy about intruding, it seemed important to retrieve what I could of the paperwork before some well-meaning relative went through and trashed everything he had. I knocked at the front door and waited. Morley had never cared much for detail, and I noticed his house had the same slapdash quality. The blue paint on the porch rail, uneven to begin with, had begun to peel with age. I had the depressing sensation of having been here before. I could picture the shoddy interior, cracked tile on the kitchen counters, buckling vinyl tile on the floors, wall-to-wall carpeting, trampled into traffic patterns that could never be cleaned of soil. The aluminum window frames would be warped, the bathroom fixtures corroded. A battered green four-door Mercury had been pulled off onto the side grass. I pegged it as Morley's, though I wasn't sure why. It was just the sort of clunker that he'd have found appealing. He had probably purchased it new in the year aughty-aught, and would have driven it resolutely until the engine died. A new red Ford Compact was parked in the driveway, the frame on the license plate advertising a local car rental company. Probably someone from out of town. Yes? The woman was small, in her mid-60s, looking energetic and competent. She wore a pink floral print blouse with long sleeves, a tweed skirt, hose, and penny loafers. Her gray hair was honest, and her makeup was light. She was in the process of drying her hands on a dish towel, her expression inquiring. "Hi, my name is Kinsey Milhone. Are you Mrs. Shine?" "I'm Dorothy's sister, Louise Mendelberg. Mr. Shine just passed away." "That's what I heard, and I'm sorry to disturb you. He was in the middle of some work for an attorney named Lonnie Kingman. I've been asked to take over his caseload. Did I come at a bad time?" "There's never going to be a good time when someone's just died," she replied tartly. This was a woman who didn't take death seriously. In its aftermath, she'd come along to do the dishes and tidy up the living room.
but she probably wouldn't devote a lot of time to the hymn selection for the funeral service.
I don't want to be more of a bother than I have to. I was sorry to hear about Morley. He was a nice man, and I liked him.
She shook her head.
I've known Morley since he and Dorothy met in college back in the Depression. We all adored him, of course, but he was such a fool. The cigarettes and his weight and all the drinking he did. You can get away with a certain amount of that when you're young, but at his age? No, ma'am. We warned him and warned him, but would he listen? Of course not. You should have seen him on Sunday. His color was awful. The doctor thinks the heart attack was aggravated by the flu he had. His electrolyte balance or something of that sort.
She shook her head again, breaking off.
How's she doing? Not that well, to tell you the truth, which is why I came down from Fresno in the first place. My intention was to help out for a couple of weeks, just to give him some relief. You know, she's been sick for months.
I didn't know that, I said.
Oh, my, yes. She's a mess. She was diagnosed with stomach cancer this last June. She had extensive surgery, and she's been taking chemotherapy off and on ever since. She's just skin and bone and can't keep a thing down. It's all Morley talked about, and here he up and went first.
Will they do an autopsy?
I don't know what she's decided about that. He just saw the doctor a week ago. Dorothy wanted him on a diet, and he finally agreed. An autopsy's not required under the circumstances, but you know how they are. Doctors like to get in there and poke and pry. I feel so sorry for her.
I made some sympathetic sounds.
She gestured briskly. Anyway, enough said. I suppose you came to take a look at his study. Why don't you step on in here and let me show you where it is? You just take what you want, and if you need to come back, you can help.